Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, people from around the world bring you the issues, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, progressive people will be bringing us stories and experiences from places like Africa and India that are too often missed by mainstream media. Why tobacco's critics go up in smoke, where plans to nationalise the tobacco industry are lighting up, and what's really happening behind your computer screen. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by Anne Landman, who's at the forefront of a project to create an online database on the tobacco industry. It's a collaborative affair involving approximately 47 million documents, previously secret documents of the internal workings of the major tobacco companies. They're now available to the public as a result of the 1998 United States Master Settlement Agreement. Can you refresh our memories about what this settlement provided, Anne?
Well, the Master Settlement Agreement was an agreement between the attorneys general of 46 U.S. states and the major American tobacco companies. It was reached in order to settle the lawsuits brought by the states against the tobacco companies to try and recoup the costs of treating sick smokers from programs, federally funded programs called Medicaid and Medicare. In other words, the tobacco companies privatized the profits of their product and socialized the cost. People would use their products and get sick, and then the federal government was left holding the bag to pick up the cost to treat emphysema and heart disease in people who had used the tobacco industry's products. And the attorneys general had sought to recoup some of that funding. In order to do that, they sued the tobacco companies, and the companies saw this as the biggest threat until that time against their industry as a whole, and sought to reach a settlement. So they drew up an agreement, and it's easy to tell that they had the biggest hand in drawing up that agreement, especially from looking at their documents. And they proposed a very detailed settlement to the attorneys general. Some of the provisions of the settlement included banning cartoon characters from advertising, so ostensibly the companies can't target children with their ads anymore, taking the cigarette ads off public transport like bus shelters, taxi cabs, out of subway stations, that type of thing. And it also included massive payments to the states over the next 25 years, or the subsequent 25 years after the agreement, that amounted to a total of about $246 billion paid out over those 25 years. So everyone sees the money. Another provision, though, was that if the companies wanted to settle, they had to turn over the documents that were released in the discovery phases of these trials. In other words, all the documents they had to turn over for all these court cases, they had to scan images of them and put them up on the internet where anyone around the world could have access to them. Because the company Brown & Williamson operated in the United States, and at the time it was owned by British American Tobacco, we also have access to British American Tobacco documents. British American Tobacco, or BAT, as we call it, operates on a global basis. It's probably the biggest transnational company. I think it is bigger than Philip Morris transnationally. So that was a huge coup for people outside the U.S. that we have access to BAT's documents too now.
So you're the editor of Tobacco Wiki, and that's an online project to actually research those 47 million documents, which is an enormous task, I can imagine.
Yes, it is, but people have already been researching them, and they've gleaned a lot of information, but most of it's been published in medical journals or academic journals, places where Most people don't have access to those types of journals. Even if you go online, in this era where some people believe in free software, a lot of these journals require subscriptions, and you have to pay to get access to their articles. They'll give you maybe a 100-word abstract, but that's all.
So is that the reason then that Tobacco Wiki was set up? Is it just to start publishing this type of material, or are there other reasons as well?
What we wanted to do is popularize it more. One thing I've always argued is that information on the tobacco industry ought to be published more in magazines like People Magazine or Newsweek or Time, instead of these dense medical journals. And I've had this argument with people in academia, and at first they won me over and said that the information will have more cachet and be cited more often if it's published in the academic and medical journals. But thinking has come around to be that the information in the documents can be of more benefit to more people if we make it more easily accessible. And similarly, we want to create databases of people involved in the industry, consultants, scientists, employees, as well as organizations that the industry has set up to do their bidding, whether it's front groups or fake research organizations, so that people understand what's going on behind the news. When they hear an organization or a person cited as a so-called expert, they can go online and find out who's been paying this person and what their involvement has been. For example, a lot of the people that we see testifying in cases as experts for big industry, polluting industries, like the power industry or pharmaceuticals, these folks worked for the tobacco industry first.
It's a very valuable source of information that that's providing, and I can imagine that searching through these documents is like mining for gems in terms of policy. You must be finding some extremely interesting trends about tobacco industry practices. What's the one that shocked you most, Anne?
Oh, gee, there is no single one, Chris. It's all been shocking to me to the point where, I've gotten kind of jaded about it. I can tell you some of the things that I've written papers on. I must have been pretty motivated by that
Go
information.
for it.
Wrote a paper about how the tobacco industry attacked other businesses who voluntarily enacted smoke-free policies. For example, a big shipper called FedEx here in the U.S., and I think they're global, came to a point where they prohibited smoking in all of their offices, trucks, all of their facilities. And if you go into the documents, you can see the letters that the heads of the tobacco companies wrote to the chief executive officer of FedEx, essentially threatening to keep their business away, use another shipper, try and cause economic harm to FedEx for this policy. Similarly, a pharmaceutical company, Merrell Dow Pharmaceuticals, who first came out with a nicotine patch, the earliest nicotine patch, advertised it in magazines that were placed in doctors' offices, and they received threats. Merrell Dow also had a chemical division, and the tobacco companies bought a chemical called glycerin that they used in their cigarettes. And if you go into the documents, you can see the correspondence that the tobacco companies sent to Merrell Dow threatening to withdraw all of their business buying glycerin if Dow Pharmaceuticals didn't pull the ads out of those doctors' magazines.
And did they? And did they pull the ads out?
I don't know, Chris. I don't know how it got resolved. I saw the threats and I reported on that. There was this level of aggression by the tobacco industry. They were kind of a bully.
If you are a tobacco company and another company is doing something that you perceive might be harming your business, why not just withdraw your business from that business? What is wrong with that?
They're entitled to do that. But, this was well after the U.S. Surgeon General had declared smoking harmful to health. And it's well known to tobacco companies that at least three-quarters of smokers would like to quit. So this was purely in the tobacco company's own financial interest without regard to the betterment of humanity or to what was to benefit of its customers. Very counter to what the government was trying to do at the time, which is reduce the amount of smoking because it was known to be damaging.
Yes, we'll be going to India in a moment to explore some of the policies that are being advocated there to actually address some of the practices that you've been talking about. Before we do that, using young people as a marketing strategy, deliberately getting them addicted before they're mature enough to take health considerations into account in their decision to smoke, is one of those trends that's just shocked the public in your country. What's being discovered in the database about marketing practices to young people in the global south?
The tobacco companies will use marketing practices elsewhere that they won't use in the United States. For example, some marketing tactics in Nigeria, bus stops and kiosks built by tobacco companies. Tobacco companies will sponsor women tourists to smoke along the west coast of Africa to make it look glamorous and like something foreign people do. In poor countries, tobacco companies will offer to buy infrastructure, pay for basketball courts or for lighting in tunnels in exchange for being able to put ads at those facilities or and to ingratiate themselves to the government so that they have an easier time in those countries. They'll sponsor inter-school cultural activities, and they will give out samples of free cigarettes. They have gift shops that have items with the names of the tobacco brands, like t-shirts, ashtrays, matches. They will put up ads featuring young people doing adventurous things. Of course, ads that don't talk about the dangers. For example, in the U.S., we require a Surgeon General's warning on every package of cigarettes. But the ads in other countries aren't required to have those kinds of warnings.
Yes.
They can only feature pictures of people having a great time windsurfing or mountain biking through a waterfall or all kinds of things that you can't really do if you smoke. Philip Morris, of course, has the Marlboro Adventure Team, and now I understand they're sponsoring folks to take a trip, you know, with the Marlboro Adventure Team and come to the American Southwest to go jeeping, you know, four-wheeling through the sand dunes and through the sandstone cliffs and that type of thing. And to get around, you know, some countries do have bans on cigarette advertising, and in those places that do, the cigarette makers come up with some very original and creative ways to get around those bans. For example, they will suddenly become, in essence, a travel agent and promote trips. You know, a trip to join the Marlboro Adventure Team, and they'll have brochures for the trip.
I understand that a couple of states in Nigeria are stacking up now to take action against the big tobacco companies. What's the essence of their claim, Anne?
The Nigerian state lawsuits are mimicking the lawsuits from the attorneys general in the United States. In other words, the states are filing suit to try and reclaim the costs to their governments of treating sick smokers. It's been a successful strategy in that the industry has never actually taken one of those suits to conclusion. They've settled all of them, and they've settled them for sizable sums, which are attractive to governments. And the documentation available on how tobacco companies are marketed in Nigeria are particularly egregious.
In what way, Anne?
Documents show that in Nigeria they've marketed to very young children. It's very clear from the wording. You know, in the States, they became very careful about the type of language that they used in their documents starting in the mid-1980s. And after a point in the American documents, you don't see them talking about youth ages 12 or 14 or 16 anymore at all. But in marketing overseas, they were much clearer about that, saying, you know, youth is as young as 9 smoke in this country, or we want to get the product into the hands of the 15-year-olds, or they're going to target those 16-year-olds with a certain type of advertising to appeal to the peer acceptance. It's almost as though they weren't worried about lawsuits in foreign countries. I was at one international conference once where a gentleman who was on a panel was from a poor country in Africa, and he said, "How can you expect us to have a system of laws against tobacco when our country hardly even has a system of laws yet at all?"
Yes.
A lot of third world countries don't have the resources to enact or police tobacco control laws, and those are the countries where people are less educated, and those are the countries that tobacco companies target.
Well, let's go now to the north of India, to the capital of Punjab, Chandigarh, where the Burning Brain Society is working out all kinds of ways to tackle these unethical practices.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Radio 3CR studios in Melbourne, Australia, and Hemant Goswami, who's the chairperson of the Burning Brain Society from Chandigarh in the north of India, has just called in for a chat. He's been talking to politicians both in India and internationally about how to nationalise the tobacco industry. But before we hear about how that's going, let's talk about what Anne has just been referring to, the kind of pressure that young people are under in India to take up smoking. What kind of pressure are they under, Hemant?
It's very important for the tobacco industry to make products attractive to youngsters. We have hundreds of thousands of documents of tobacco industry which shows how they have been doing this. In a very subtle manner, they advertise in movies, they do product placements. Advertisement is more or less banned in most of the countries. So they are resorting to indirect method, sponsoring cricket events, which is a very popular thing over here in the subcontinent, and things like that to create a relation between tobacco and beauty. Tobacco and sexual attractiveness.
That's a killer though, isn't it? Literally, the sexual attraction part of things, actually holding out to young people that tobacco smoking is sexy and it's adult. How can you break that cycle in India?
These companies are placing their product in movies. They show brave heroes, strong heroes smoking cigarettes immediately after they have a fight, or young females, smart-looking, good-looking females consuming tobacco in movies. We did a survey on this, we did full-fledged scientific research on this, and we found that there was 13% increase in the number of movies which showed tobacco now. There were 45% movies which showed a tobacco brand. And we discussed about this. The health minister was ready. He said we should have a law which prohibit depiction of these kind of things in movies. A new law which restrict tobacco depiction in Indian movies. Unfortunately, that law is being contested and it is on hold now.
I'm wondering too, can you tell us, are young people able to afford cigarettes in India?
In India, we have a wide range of tobacco products. They come from a small gutkha pouch, which is a chewing tobacco. It costs 1 rupee for one pouch, which means in one Australian dollar, you can buy around 30 such tobacco pouch which are consumed orally. Besides, you also have another variety which is called bidi. Bidi again comes for around 3 rupees a pouch. That means for one Australian dollar, around 10-12 packs, you can buy around 200 bidis. It's like a mini small cigarette, indigenous cigarette. So tobacco products are still very affordable in India and youngsters have access to them and can buy them. Another thing which we must understand is tobacco kills half of its all users. In India, the number of people who die due to tobacco is 1 million. So tobacco industry has to replace all those people who are killed by using its product. This is the only product which kills its users and find out new consumers who can consume this product. Over here in Chandigarh, the first thing we did was block the access of youngsters to tobacco products. Now, no tobacco shop can sell any product to any youngster below 18 years of age.
So you've questioned how a product like tobacco, which kills, as you said, 5.4 million people each year, can still be regarded as a legal product. How do lawmakers greet this proposition? And I'm wondering too whether or not there's been any moves in your city to actually ban the sale of tobacco.
You are absolutely correct and you have hit the nail on the head. It's quite unfortunate that in a civilized world, we still have a product like tobacco which kills millions of people and it still remains legal. There's an industry which is very powerful, which is bribing people, politicians, to keep it legal. That's quite unfortunate because politicians who are responsible to safeguard our health, who are supposed to work for public welfare, are basically negating this important fact. Now, for example, if you have any pharmaceutical product, even a medicine, a useful concoction, which kills even a single person across the globe due to its side effects, it would be off the shelf from across the world. So we have these kind of standards, but we are not bothered about a product like tobacco, which kills people when used as intended. It's the only product which kills people when used as intended. Yes, there is a move to discontinue tobacco as a consumer product. We are working on that move also. There has to be a long-term phase of plan so that over a period of 20 years, we can eliminate tobacco as a consumer product. We are already working on that.
I can imagine that there would be quite a lot of opposition from, for instance, tobacco farmers to an idea like that, because you'd have to have an incredibly long lead time to actually re-educate farmers to do another trade. That must be one component of your equation. How difficult do you think that will be?
India is one of the three largest tobacco growing nations in the world. So even in a place like India, the total revenue contributed to the GDP of India is around 0.24%. So that's not much. Now, let's assume a case where tobacco is phased out. This particular economic contribution is going to be replaced by the alternate crop which is grown on that area. That land which is now used for cultivation of tobacco would be used for cultivation of alternate crop. By talking about a 10 to 20 year phase out plan, we are sure that we can take care of everyone, including the tobacco industry. If you just reduce it by, say, 10% every year, you reduce the production, you work at the supply side. Every year, if you reduce 10% over a period of 20 years, the total supply of tobacco would be reduced to 14 to 15% of what it is right now. At that point of time, you can easily wrap it out. We have to understand that we won't only be working on the supply side, we would also be working on the demand side. Supply side and demand side and reduction of tobacco and paying back the shareholders, promoting alternate crops with the farmers. So there has to be a whole combination of different kind of strategies. And I am very sure, I'm absolutely convinced that this type of thing is possible. The only thing what we require is a political will to do that. And I see it's quite possible. If the political will is not there, you should not be surprised if judiciary in some country comes out and say, no, this is an unsafe product, it has to go.
And what do your parliamentarians say to you about that? Do they say that they will consider making tobacco illegal?
There are two categories of politicians right now. One category of politicians who are in minority certainly right now, they think this kind of thing is possible. Our health minister in India, initially he was not very convinced about the idea. But then in a press conference I asked him, I said right now, 1 million people are dying in India. 5.4 million people are dying globally. So by all this tobacco control effort, what do we want? Do we want 0.8 million people to die? Or instead of 5.54 million, do we want 5 million people to die? I mean, are we just interested to reduce the death toll marginally? Or we are interested that not a single person should die due to tobacco use? The health minister saw the point. And today, when you speak to him, he says the national policy is to ultimately end tobacco as a consumer product.
Wow.
So the health minister is quite convinced, but Parliament of India is not run by the health minister. There are other ministers, there are around 800 members of parliament.
Yes.
So we have to have a majority to convince the parliament to come out with a law, come out with a policy to phase out tobacco. It's going to take some time, but we are working on it. I don't think we will give up, and I'm sure if we keep on working on this, we can make a lot of people see reason in what we are proposing right now.
Because you've also argued that the tobacco industry should be taken over by the government through privatisation. Essentially, the industry should be privatised or should be taken over by other public interest organisations. What's your thinking here, Hemant?
This is one of the possibilities. If you ask them to voluntarily do certain things and keep on claiming different kind of legislation and expect that they are going to follow everything, I think the evidence does not point toward this. The evidence till now is that tobacco industry tries to circumvent the legislations you bring on. So one of the ways is to basically take over the tobacco industry. Governments all over the world nationalize certain industry in their national interest. Tobacco is a perfect for that. Tobacco industry can be taken over by the government. That only means that it will be controlled by the government. All the shareholders and everybody else having any interest in that industry can retain their interest. In the term, government can act as a custodian. And as and when we have a 10-year or 20-year phase-out, we can always pay those shareholders back some amount of money or maybe whatever the market worth of their share is. This way, it won't be a burden on the government because government would be outright purchasing the industry. It won't be purchasing. It would be just be taking over as a custodian. That is one of the possibilities. The second thing is to take it as a non-profit industry. Why should any person in this world earn money out of other person's misery and death? There's no reason, there's no logic for that. So the other thing is to run it as a non-profit and to sort of block all the brands, can have a single pack without a brand and that kind of thing. So that is another possibility. So we are working on other economic models also. There are other models also. If we use any of them, I think, or a combination of them, I'm sure we can find a solution.
This looks like a perfect place to bring Anne Landman into our conversation. Anne's at the forefront of a project we've been talking about today to create an online database on the tobacco industry. Anne Landman, radical stuff, outlawing tobacco. How far away are countries in the rich world from outlawing tobacco, do you think?
You know, Chris, I don't think that outlawing tobacco is the way to go, I have to say. It doesn't work. You know, we tried in this country to outlaw alcohol in the 1920s to the 1930s, and that, while it had some moderate success in reducing alcohol consumption, it was reversed ultimately and widely viewed as being a policy flop. Also, if you outlaw it, then you catapult yourself into the area where you have to consider black markets, and then you have no control over the product whatsoever. So a total ban on tobacco is not the answer for the time being. You still have hundreds of millions of people who are addicted to the product around the world and are going to seek a way to get it. And you're going to have a lot of people looking for profits, even still, who want to supply that need. So I think you're looking at a dangerous situation going that way.
Hammond has raised a number of other interesting ideas. Anne, what's your feedback there?
I think he and I have been reading the same books. His idea of turning the tobacco industry into a non-profit model rather than a for-profit model corporation is an idea that, to my knowledge, was first floated in Canada. Neil Collishaw, Cynthia Callard, and Dave Thompson, who've written a book, they advocate essentially turning the tobacco industry from a for-profit business model into a non-profit business model where the non-profit has a mission of benefiting public health. We can equate their idea to turning it into something like the American Cancer Society or the Lung Association, where they operate off a mission, and that's to reduce disease, reduce cancer, or reduce lung disease, rather than to maximize their profits. And the business model requires that any profits these organizations make be plowed back into advancing their mission, rather than lining their own pockets.
So you're saying, Anne, that they realize there's an addiction there that needs to be catered for, but still operate handling or managing that addiction as well as operating for the public interest?
Exactly. It's going to be a long process to reduce the amount of addiction that exists in the world to this product. It's not going to be done overnight. And when I explain this, and I can use my hands, I like to indicate, use my fingers to show an upward spiral. That's the spiral that we're in now, where the tobacco industry has to always pour more money into advertising their product and increasing their use because they're required to maximize profits for their stakeholders by law. By law, they're required to maximize profits. So if we change the business model and then we start making that spiral go downward, reducing the amount of advertising, encouraging more people to quit, showing them more where the resources are to quit, using the money generated by tobacco instead of ramping up the use of it to work on declining the use of it. But there are some other problems involved in this, Chris, and that is the vested interests that governments currently have in maintaining the tobacco industry because they charge tax on the product.
Absolutely.
And they use those taxes to fund other things that are unrelated.
The health system.
Health system, road repairs, education. They're very vested in maintaining the tobacco industry for that reason. So tax structures have to be taken into account.
There's the other point you were raising earlier too, Anne, which was how tobacco companies plan to resist laws that will rein them in.
They do actively resist laws. I'm looking at one document now. Philip Morris is kind of describing their victories around the world in the past couple of years for policy. I'm looking for the date. It was from the mid-80s. But they say the government in Hong Kong responded to Philip Morris' pressure by narrowing the differential between duties on imported leaf and finished cigarettes, significantly benefiting Philip Morris. In Brazil, we achieved a significant tax decrease. In South Australia, Philip Morris significantly watered down an anti-smoking tobacco products control bill. In Quebec, Benson and Hedges pressed the government to overturn its ad valorem system of taxation on tobacco products. Through Philip Morris's effort, the Gulf Coast Council health ministers delayed health warnings and maximum constituent labeling on cigarette packs. In Venezuela, we were successful in stopping a detrimental self-regulating advertising code. Our work in Senegal resulted in a new advertising decree which reversed a total advertising ban. So this shows Philip Morris was hard at work on policy in countries all around the world and made significant gains.
Absolutely. And where is that published?
This was an international corporate affairs memorandum that was sent to the Philip Morris Board of Directors in December 1986. So, you know, when they present things to the Board of Directors, of course, they're going to be self-congratulatory.
And represent the corporate
achievements.
Represent the corporate culture that's operating at that time.
Exactly. Mm.
Hemant, I understand there's cause for celebration this month in Chandigarh, which is your city, a very interesting city, actually. It was the first planned city in India, and now, in another first, it has become this month a smoke-free city. Your organisation, the Burning Brain Society, has been one of the prime movers and shakers in actually bringing about this change to the city. Is this smoke-free city going to be the first of many in India, or a standalone?
Right now, Chandigarh is going to be the first smoke-free city. Our next target is the state of Punjab. We intend to make it smoke-free. And I've been told by the Ministry of Health and Family Welfare that they also propose to work on Delhi and Mumbai, which would be smoke-free by 2009. And in Chandigarh, we have created a good model which can be replicated and scaled up. The model which we have created over here in Chandigarh can be used anywhere in the world. I mean, if not in the world, at least in Southeast Asia, where we have similar conditions and similar socioeconomic background. So the model of Chandigarh is open for replication by anyone. Now, Chandigarh is the only city state to go smoke-free. That means we have a distinct advantage over other places, other cities and states. We can offer what no other state or city can give. That is a smoke-free, clean, healthy environment. Going smoke-free means no cigarette smoking or no tobacco use anywhere in any of the public places, no cigarette smoking in any hotels or restaurants, no cigarette smoking or selling of tobacco products in and near educational institutes, and a lot of other such places. The only catch over here is, according to Indian legislation, big hotels can have a separate smoking space within their premises. Internationally, it has been observed that when you go smoke-free, you are likely to increase tourism, the revenue increases, and contrary to the popular belief, the sale of restaurants and hotel actually increases.
That's really interesting what you've just said, because I would have thought that hotels and bars wouldn't have liked this development.
Washington, D.C. is smoke-free, New York is smoke-free, California is smoke-free. So there are smoke-free laws, there are smoke-free places, there are other smoke-free places in the world. But till now, they were only in the developing countries. In developing or underdeveloped countries, India, Chandigarh is the first place to go smoke-free.
Hmm.
This is more important because, according to WHO statistics, by 2030, 8 out of 10 people who die due to tobacco would be from developing or underdeveloped or economies in transition. So there's a shift of burden from the developing countries to the underdeveloped countries and the countries in transition. So going smoke-free in a developing country like India and in a progressive state like Chandigarh is certainly a wonderful achievement, I think.
Well, congratulations, Hemant Goswami. Hemant Goswami is the chairperson of the Burning Brain Society, which was one of the NGOs that was at the vanguard of making his city, Chandigarh, smoke-free. It was great to talk to you today, Hemant.
Thank you very much, Chris. It was my pleasure.
That was Maha Shakti, meaning beyond the sun, on Debashish Bhattacharya's amazing album, Calcutta Slide Guitar. More about that later in the program. I'm Chris Richards, and you're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to radios, computers, and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And while we're talking about computers, open, accessible information must enhance our ability as societies to make better decisions and choices. But if the big software companies have their way, it's them, not us, who are going to be making decisions about what information we can get and when we can get it. Peter Brown is the executive director of the Free Software Foundation. He's just dropped in from Boston. Peter, the information superhighway is supposed to be open to us all. What kind of things are companies like Microsoft doing to position themselves to become the gatekeepers?
Well, of course, Microsoft have for many years used their dominance in the operating system field to restrict what users can do and obviously to limit competition. With their latest iteration of their operating system, Vista, they have built an operating system with one goal in mind, and that is more control, give them more power. They've done this by making Vista a digital restrictions management platform. That's more commonly known as DRM, by its initials, DRM. DRM limits you in what you can do with digital media files, either sound recordings or video. It does this, they say, at the behest of big media to prevent piracy. That's the way they like to frame it anyway. But really, what Microsoft are attempting to do here is to create a gateway through which all users must pass if they're to get access to digital media. And in doing so, they hope to yet again put themselves in a position of dominance in the operating system field. Now, the problem with these restrictions are that they can, in fact, affect very simple activist work, such as copying digital files from government documents and sharing digital files, whether it be activist recordings of protests or anything else. Vista has the ability to, at any time in the future, also change those restrictions, or typically, of course, to increase those restrictions. And in fact, we've seen that type of behavior become more commonplace now, that in the disguise of a upgrade, new restrictions can be added to the computer that you own.
My organisation is shifting to free software at the moment, and I'd like to talk about the benefits of that shift in just a minute. My computer currently has Microsoft and Norton's, and I've noticed recently that it's starting to load programs onto my system that I haven't even requested. How come this is permissible?
Well, unfortunately, you agreed to it. Microsoft Vista, and in fact most proprietary software, comes with something that people refer to as a EULA. It's an end user license agreement. And typically it's when you're in the midst of downloading something, a lot of text comes up, which you never read. It's, you know, several pages long, minute writing, and, you know, no one actually bothers to read that. But typically what it says is that you give us authority to, from time to time, make upgrades to the software that you're running. These are typically under the heading of something like either patches or improvements to functionality of the software you're using. But actually, they typically add restrictions. Typically, they don't tell you what the software does.
This is frightening stuff, Peter, isn't it? Because it actually is what we read about in the Project for the New American Century put out before the Bush administration, where in a document produced by the likes of Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney, well, I should say that was the landmark document that flagged the need for invading Iraq. It talks there about the information superhighway being full of pirates at the moment and the need to cordon that off for business. What you're describing is the start of that process, by the sound of it.
Exactly. What's important to realise, of course, is that the internet is a tool for liberty, and we are seeing the entrenched interests be really challenged by the new way that we have of communicating with each other. We are removing big media as the key source of information we have to develop our understanding of the world. We now turn towards and respect commentators who, through their expertise, we trust. We've certainly seen this within the IT field. Now, DRM individual restrictions are being put in place in an attempt to establish a new type of control over the internet and a new type of control over the voices that we end up hearing.
Mm.
If you can imagine that there are maybe only one or two blessed gateways through which you can get to see video or music or movies, whether it be iTunes or whether it be, you know, something like YouTube or iTunes, controlling those gateways is key for them, because that's where people's attentions can be most effectively diverted from alternative media and from alternative news sources. So, for instance, what we're tending to see within the free software realm is that because to impose DRM requires a third party to be in control of your computer, and because we won't allow that within free software, it's a real threat to adoption of free software, because people, of course, like to watch movies and listen to music. And the idea that you won't be able to do that using free software, again, establishes them back in control and, again, gives them that monopoly position.
Peter, I'm wondering, what seems to be happening now is that there'll be a step up in terms of access to broadband. The more you pay, the greater access you'll get, the greater speed you'll get. People who've got dial-up facilities or broadband, as we know it at the moment, are going to get left behind in terms of being able to access sites. Is this
That's
the
right.
What do you see in terms of that occurring now, and what can be done about that?
The problem we face is that whilst we might be able to resist moves made by corporations, the problem that is still there is their influence over legislative bodies. So here in the United States, we have an ongoing battle being waged between the telecoms. The telecoms have had this monopoly given to them for free by the U.S. government, which they are using vast resources to maintain by lobbying politicians and trying to get legislation passed which will further entrench their monopoly position. Here in the US, it's referred to as the issue round of network neutrality. The idea is that the telecoms would like to erect gateways in the tubes of the internet that would prevent certain information from flowing. It would effectively mean that they could decide which information is premium, which information therefore ends up being blocked. For instance, this interview today is being transmitted through Skype. We're talking through Skype. Now, the idea is that that's obviously a direct threat to the entrenched telecoms, and they would like to restrict that to lower the quality of the voice connection, and they want to do that with lots of other types of transmissions.
And can they do that? I mean, because Skype, of course, is free, and there's a really direct benefit for organisations like ours, which is a non-profit organisation using Skype technology. Will they be able to do that?
Yes, so what they can do is they can easily identify types of information being passed. And so what they can typically do is downgrade the service that you're using so that, for instance, voice communications, those packets of data can be slowed down, effectively making communication more difficult. Now, this can only really be achieved if they're able to manipulate legislation.
Mm.
Unfortunately, they have a long history of being very successful at this. I mentioned earlier on that digital restrictions management are a threat to our freedoms because it's allowing them to erect gateways and to control what it is that we can view and do with our computers. Now, the reason why that's a problem is because in the United States, and this unfortunate legislation through trade treaties has now passed through to most of the rest of the world, it passed a law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, obviously in the year 2000. And the idea of the act was to make it illegal, make an offense to circumvent a DRM scheme. So, for instance, if a DRM scheme is preventing me from copying a piece of music and the programmer find a way to get around that and make a copy of the music, I would have effectively broken the law. And it's through that legislation that they're able to enforce those kinds of draconian controls. So the problem we face is one of legislation. If we can keep legislation at bay, I believe for the next, you know, 3 or 4 years, we will hopefully entrench freedom into the internet society. So I think we're at quite an important point at the moment in time. If we can make sure we end up with net neutrality, that would be one key fight that we should look towards.
What you've described is a system which actually favours the multimedia entertainment industry information that's coming through computers, rather than restricts our access to, for instance, activist sites. Are we seeing any restrictions, or are we seeing any moves to restrictions of the type of information that we want to read on the internet and perhaps in the future won't be able to?
Well, probably the most commonly documented activity around this area at the moment is in relation to the major search engines and China. Both Yahoo and Google are the two major destinations for people wanting to carry out search on the internet. Both those organizations have decided to accept China's repression of activists, and they have been handing over information on activists, and that handing over of information has led to activists being detained and punished. That's a trend that will continue because those types of oppressions will move from China to other nations as that type of behavior is allowed. You know, whilst corporations like Google and Yahoo allow that to happen, it will encourage other nations to adopt similar policies for monitoring. It revolves around things like pornography and drugs and any type of behavior associated with peace movement. Those kinds of activities we're seeing more and more are being restricted. And because Google and Yahoo have now given way to those local jurisdictions and handing over information, it would appear to me that that will likely encourage the transfer of that behavior to other nation states.
So you're saying, in effect then, Peter, that this is the thin end of the wedge, what we're seeing in China at the moment, that it's the start of the building of culture that accepts the actual blocking of information in what the companies regard as the government's interest or the government's regard as their interest as well?
Well, it's a tug of war. I mean, at the same time that we're seeing those attempts, we're seeing defences being erected to protect the free world, in that sense, to protect, you know, people who care about activism and want to improve social justice. You know, it's very hard to put this genie back in the bottle. They're certainly attempting to do that. But through campaigns against the adoption of Microsoft Vista, we are helping to raise the profile of this issue. And in fact, mostly it's security experts who have traditionally been very supportive of proprietary software companies. It's now the security experts which have started to turn against products like Vista because of the dangers they represent. So,
Really? Like, yeah, who, for instance?
Well, there are a couple of key experts who, in fact, we highlight in a recent paper that we're distributing with Friends of the Earth International and the Green Party, England and Wales, in which we are calling attention to some of the problems with Microsoft Vista and calling upon activists to switch to free software.
This looks like a perfect place to bring Anne Landman into our conversation, Peter. Anne's at the forefront of a project we've been talking about today to create an online database on the tobacco industry. And I'm wondering, the developments that Peter was talking about earlier in his conversation, they're capable of impacting on your online project. I'm wondering what your thoughts were about that.
Well, as I was listening to Peter, I thought our project is aimed at doing the opposite of what Microsoft is, and that's we aim to take information that was once very proprietary and make it easily accessible to anyone around the globe that can be altered, a body of information that can be altered by people around the globe who may have more information on a particular topic or subject.
I'm wondering how you react to what Peter says about the lack of security that is building up around activist sites at the moment. It would seem that Tobacco Wiki is a site which actually directly challenges the tobacco industry and what it's actually offering the public, and we've heard about that earlier in the program. I'm wondering whether or not there is any concerns that you have in that project about access to information being blocked from members of the public.
Well, the Center for Media and Democracy employs me. They run a site called sourcewatch.org. It's a wiki project that anyone can come on and enter information into the database. So far, we've had to do very little blocking of our sites, mostly to avoid vandalism, if it does occur, to people who don't like the articles about them and come on and try and alter the data on themselves. If they do that, we warn them, and if they persist in doing it and changing the site, completely to suit their fancy instead of what the facts show, then they are blocked from the site. But personally, I'm amazed at how little vandalism we've had and how little we've had to implement blocking of sites.
47 million documents, Anne. It's a big ask and a fantastic public interest project. Where would people go to find out more about Tobacco Wiki?
Well, our project is just at the beginning right now. We just rolled it out on a soft launch, and people are welcome to come and look at the site. If they know something we don't, they can contribute to the site. And it can be found at www.tobaccowiki.org. That's all one word, spelled TOBACCOWIKI.org.
And Anne Landman is the editor of Tobacco Wiki, a project facilitated by the Centre for Media Democracy. Anne, delighted to talk to you today. Thank you very much for joining our program.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
And good luck.
Thank you.
Can I ask, Peter, in terms of Wikipedia and the type of project that Anne is involved in, a Wikipedia for tobacco, what can you see on the horizon in terms of difficulties for projects like that, open access information projects?
Actually, I can't see many problems with that. I think this is the way we're heading. The key thing, I think, for any activist now is to build a community around their resources. What we're seeing is many what people refer to as social networking sites and also social news gathering sites. And because now we're not limited in our scope to just the street we live on or the city we live in, that we can reach out beyond that, we can find people quite quickly who share our interests, who historically have never been able to be connected. And so in a sense, we can build larger communities than we ever have done before. And it's through the strength of that built-up community that we can best protect ourselves.
And what can you and I do about that, Peter? Where can I get further information about it and what can I do about it?
Well, obviously, I work for the Free Software Foundation, and I would recommend people join the free software community. There's a big community out there. In fact, we have, in a sense, technologists have quite a dominant space on the internet. And so, in fact, I would suggest people use free software. And it's very easy these days to get hold of distribution of GNU Linux. If they're using a web browser, I would suggest they use Firefox. If you're actually using a Microsoft computer and you don't feel comfortable switching to a new operating system, you can try a browser to begin with, or you can replace Microsoft Office with OpenOffice. It's a very good utility to replace Excel and Word. And join a community, start monitoring what's going on in this field, and look out for legislation. Unfortunately, in countries like Australia and New Zealand, there are already moves underway to make DMCA laws a major part of legislation activity, I think, this year. So it's really opposed that type of legislation.
And what of the UK and Canada?
Unfortunately, the UK already has DMCA laws. Now, one of the things people can do is join one of our campaigns. It's called defectivebydesign.org. We're campaigning against DRM. One of the ways we're doing that is if we can convince consumers that DRM is not in their interests, then this whole economic underpinning of DRM can fail. So, for instance, our campaign against DRM this year has seen the first major music label make a decision to drop DRM. So EMI, which is, I think, the fourth largest distributor of music, they have now dropped DRM from their catalog. So you can now buy music online from EMI, which doesn't have DRM on it. So they're the first one to crack. Apple themselves now distribute music on iTunes without DRM. And Amazon.com will be launching a site later this year. It's the first time they've distributed music online, and they will only be distributing music without DRM. So don't buy Vista, don't buy Microsoft Vista, don't buy HD DVD, and don't buy Blu-ray. Those are probably the most important things that people can do to really affect the adoption of DRM, and to superpower can have a real effect here.
Pete Brown, that was fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm just wondering, before you go, what about a website for people who want to go and get more information?
The home of the Free Software Foundation. So if you take the initials of our name, that's F for free, S for software, and F for foundation, fsf.org. You can come and read all about free software and find a bit more about our campaigns for computer user freedom.
Good on you, Peter. Bye for now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
And while we're saying thank you, a big thanks as usual to our associate producer, Rachel Maher, because it's time for us to say goodbye to you too. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Indian musician Debashish Bhattacharya has been starring this week with three guitars, a trinity of guitars that he designed himself. In Indian cosmology, the trinity is a powerful symbol. For instance, trinetra, Sanskrit for three eyes, represents past, present and future. Together, the guitars straddle the styles of 1,000 years of Indian music. The result? The CD Calcutta Slide Guitar. It's already attracting award nominations. You'll find it on the World Music Network's website, which is www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find copies of this program, www.newint.org. I'm Chris Richards. Let's chat again next week.